Ave podcast listeners, two quick notices before we start the podcast today. We are now in the closing hours of fundraising for a podcast mini-series on the Illyrian Wars. It's four episodes, it features Dr. Christopher Gribben and myself, it's $12 Australian, and it will be available to supporters only. You can find it on kickstarter.com, and I've also put links on social media. Second notice, Rhiannon and myself will soon be recording one of our regular Q&A episodes. So if you have any cues that you would like aid in regards to ancient Rome or perhaps to the podcast itself, you can put it in the relevant thread on Facebook, send us a tweet, we are at Rome Podcast, or you can email it to us, emperorspodcast@gmail.com. And bonus points goes to anyone who presses record on their phone, records their question, and emails it through to us. The episode should be out before the end of the year. And on that note, here's the podcast. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXXI, Champion of the People. Gaius Gracchus, or inspiring and passionate to exaggeration, a demagogue pure and simple, seemingly shunned the family business, at least to begin with. But however much you try to defer your fate, sometimes decisions are made for you. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Gaius Gracchus was Tiberius Gracchus's younger brother by 9 years. And as we'll see, he pretty much follows in his footsteps career-wise and end-wise.
His entire life was kind of dominated by the actions of his brother. I wonder what he would have been like if none of that stuff happened to Tiberius.
Yeah, as we'll see, Plutarch in his biography, he pairs Tiberius and Gaius together, kind of in one biography. He does strive to differentiate them to show us a different personality with Gaius, but as his life works out, it's fairly similar and he seems to be striving for the same kinds of things. It sort of makes me think of, I haven't had experience of this, but I know when you're in school, if you've got an older sibling, you're often compared.
Well, straight away when you introduced him, you've gone, this is the younger brother of Tiberius. Yeah. Straight away, he's just gone, oh, thanks.
So. Well, the whole family is kind of expressed in relation to one another, isn't it? Because we started with Cornelia and
the
what is her
of
title?
The Gracchi, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the daughter of Scipio Africanus.
But far less than the mother of the Gracchi, that she's kind of constructed like that, at least afterwards, if not during their lives. Anyway.
Plutarch compares Tiberius and Gaius to each other and stresses how different they are. So we can piece together a bit of Gaius's personality and how he presents himself. So what can we tell about Gaius?
He's described at first almost as not wanting to follow in those footsteps, of living a quiet life, which doesn't really match up with the way he turns out later. So I guess if Plutarch's right, there must have been some kind of big change in his personality. So he says at the beginning, he sort of lives away from the forum, so not in the public eye and keeping quiet, lived quietly by himself, as if he wants to live in some sort of humble and inactive way, he says, so that some people actually criticize him for not immediately carrying on his brother's legacy. It's unclear whether he then reacts to that, responds to that criticism, or as he grows older, because he is 9 years younger, he develops an interest in continuing these reforms, these largely land reforms that Tiberius had been trying to push forward. Plutarch gives us largely a fairly positive picture of his character. He says, this is a good line I like, he showed a disposition that was averse to idleness, effeminacy, wine-bibbing, imbibing, we would say, or drinking, and money-making. Those four things, they tick off what you want in a good Roman, all right? That they're not drunken, that they're not obsessed with women and sex, that they're not effeminate. So he's a manly man, and they're hardworking. I think even Gaius's critics don't claim that he's lazy.
Yeah.
And also, we're told over and over again that he is a fantastic speaker. He's great at rhetoric. He starts out as a defender, defending Vettius, a friend who's being prosecuted. And he basically wins the case just by being such a fantastic speaker. He inspires sympathy in all who are listening.
He also seemed like he's very dynamic and persuasive and passionate, whereas Tiberius, he was very measured and constrained. So you're very much given that opposite kind of thing. So
it's very hard to tell because largely our picture of Gaius, of course, is constructed by Plutarch. That's our main source. We do have a little bit from the historian Appian as well, just slightly later. and they both have their own axes to grind. And I think for Plutarch in particular, it's making that distinction between the two of them. Mm. So maybe he stresses the differences a little more or just exaggerates them. I'm not sure that we can say there's no substance with Gaius, but yes, he certainly comes off as a more extravagant speaker, as more showy. And some Romans would have criticized that. Mm. That's something that's drawing attention to yourself too much. So Gaius's speaking style and the amount of effort that he puts into it is pretty clear from Plutarch telling us about how he trains and how he makes sure when he's speaking that he keeps this kind of high grade of oratory going. Mm. So Plutarch says Gaius was harsh and fiery, so that against his better judgment, he was often carried away by anger as he spoke. So it's like he's not always completely in control of it, raising his voice to a high pitch and uttering abuse and losing the thread of his discourse. I know what that's like. So to guard against such digressions, he employed an intelligent servant, Licinius, who stood behind him when he was speaking, with a sounding instrument for giving the tones of the voices their pitches.
Whenever, this is like a tuning fork, is it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. So that he can bring it down a tone, I guess, and not get, you know, hysterical.
Okay, all right, yeah.
Whenever this servant noticed that the voice of Gaius was getting harsh and broken with anger, maybe it's not high-pitched, but anyway, harsh and broken, he would give out a soft keynote, on hearing which Gaius would at once remit the vehemence of his passion and of his speech. He would grow gentle and show himself easy to recall. So it kind of brings him back to a more level tone and reminds him. I think the implication is that he's sort of losing the track, that the syntax of his sentences is breaking down, which can actually be quite effective oratory to show you're so impassioned in the moment, but you don't want to get too carried away or stop making sense. I think it just shows us how important oratory is to the Romans, but that Gaius is almost taking it that stage further. Mm. So they do have training. It's part of their school training. It's really important that you can command an audience, both in the Senate and amongst the people. But clearly the fact that Plutarch is pointing this out, that he has this person while he's speaking, there's a good and bad going on here, isn't there? That he's so involved that he gets carried away, but the fact that he gets carried away means he has to be brought back to normal levels by this servant. Notice he's an intelligent servant, though.
Yeah, you've got to be to get the good tone, I guess,
To know when it's going wrong.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah.
We do get with Gaius some suggestion sometimes that it's kind of about him more than the reforms, right? That he's constructing himself as a celebrity, we might say. Immediately, Plutarch says, this is still in only halfway through chapter one, he's told us that Gaius's oratory is immediately apparent, his skill here. And straight away, he says that there's some in the senatorial group who want to prevent him becoming a tribune. Mm-hmm. Now, this might be with the benefit of hindsight, but he implies that they are trying to prevent him getting there even before he's thought of it himself. We don't want another one of those Gracchi.
You already said that he didn't immediately seek office and he kind of wanted the quiet life, but I get the impression that that's very quickly out of his hands. There's just too much of the expectation that either he's going to be the one to continue Tiberius's push, mm-hmm. to continue his legacy, and from the Senate, that this is the guy that we need to watch out for. He's going to be dangerous.
Yeah, I wonder, and it is, there's a little bit of supposition here, but almost the Senate, by trying to block him, push him forward to do this. It's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that they fear it, therefore they make moves to prevent him, and that might encourage him further. It's not his very first role, though. He had been drawn into Tiberius's land commission back in 133. Mm. He would have been very young at this point. He'd have been about 21.
Yeah.
So he is considered an adult, but too young really for any magistracies. And now this will become normal later in the imperial period for very young men to be elevated. But at this point, it probably seemed quite revolutionary. It might be an indication of why the Senate was so wary of him, that he'd already been part of this movement for change.
Yeah, yeah.
But a few years later, and of course after Tiberius has been murdered, he goes on a more traditional career path where he becomes a quaestor in the province of Sardinia. So a military magistrate. He's serving under a consul. His enemies are very happy that they've got him out of Rome.
He seems quite happy as well, doesn't he? He's fond of war,
Plutarch
says. We're
told he's fond of war, yes. But also, there's an indication, I think, in Plutarch that while the Senate thinks that they've got rid of him, he knows he can use this experience to his own advantage, that he can make a name for himself here. I think the Senate just think they've got him somewhere slightly obscure and they can forget about him. He gets the locals in Sardinia to provide for the army. Previously, that had just been taken from them.
Mm.
And basically, he ends up with the same thing, but by not just taking it, but by making
them feel... Now it was their idea.
Yeah, making them feel sympathy for the soldiers during the winter. So he's a very good negotiator. So for all of this, you know, he's fiery and passionate.
Mm.
When he does sit down to diplomacy, he seems very effective.
Yeah. And he's also got the Gracchi reputation at this point. So there was a king in Numidia who pretty much gave them a lot of grain just because Gaius Gracchus was there and part of it.
Out of regard for Gaius Gracchus.
Mm.
His name means something. And we're told in Plutarch that the Senate, therefore, are starting to be suspicious.
That's enough to get them worried.
He's too high profile.
Yeah.
This is part of the story of the late Republic, of course. When individuals stand out too much, the Senate starts to worry. But they're particularly worried when he's got the surname Gracchus.
This is really the start of him getting drawn into a public life, isn't it? Even though he doesn't necessarily want it.
Yeah, he makes the most of his Sardinia experience. He says, I'm the only man. Whenever anyone says, I'm the only person, you start to be suspicious, who's gone to a province with less money than I went with. Roman magistrates will make money basically by exploiting the locals, even stealing from them. And he says, no, I spent money. I lost money.
Mm.
So he's got the high moral ground, which is kind of a good footing for a political career. So Cicero tells us, and Plutarch also reports this, but it comes originally from De Divitione, book one. Gaius Gracchus told many persons that his brother Tiberius came to him in a dream when he was a candidate for the quaestorship and said, however much you may try to defer your fate, nevertheless you must die the same death that I did.
Mm.
This actually sort of rings true. A is something that might have been said afterwards because, spoilers, the fate will be the same. But B, the Romans have a lot of faith in dreams and in fate.
Mm.
So it wouldn't be surprising if it were said even during his life. And I think it sums up the idea that certainly the Romans have afterwards that this was bound to happen.
Yes.
It was bound to happen because he's the younger brother of Tiberius.
So the Senate tries to change the law so that Gaius Gracchus stays in Sardinia away from home.
Yep. Let's try and trap him there. He's done too well there, so we don't want him to come back and make use of that.
Yeah, so essentially your term of service should end and you should return.
Yeah, and he is told that he's abandoned his post when he comes back, although his argument is, well, I've already spent twice as long there as is the normal term.
Yeah.
So what are you on about?
Yeah, he essentially comes back to Rome to argue against whatever law they're trying to put into place there to keep him there, which he does successfully.
Yes, he does. So these are trumped up charges and he gets past them. So he's elected to be tribune in 123 BCE and straight away he goes on the attack.
Yes.
So he gets to make a speech.
Celebratory oratory. Wow.
Yeah, his kind of maiden speech as tribune, I suppose we might call it in our parliament.
Yeah, sure. If you want to be able to pronounce it properly, I should let you try and say that.
Plutarch may have made this up, this speech, but it's an indicator at least of the way that he thought that Gaius spoke.
Mm.
He says, but before your eyes, these men beat Tiberius to death with clubs. So he's taking on the people in the Senate who killed his brother, which actually would be really weird, wouldn't it, to be in a body with people who'd murdered your own brother.
Yes.
So I think it's fair enough.
No, he drags it out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He says these men...
That's a poor source of words on my part, but off you go.
These men beat Tiberius to death with clubs and his dead body was dragged from the capital through the midst of the city to be thrown into the Tiber. Moreover, those of his friends who were caught were put to death without trial, which, of course, is a criminal act for a Roman citizen to have that happen to them. And yet it is ancient usage among us that if anyone who is arraigned on capital charge does not answer to his summons, a trumpeter shall go to the door of this man's house in the morning and summon him forth by the sound of a trumpet. And until this has been done, the judges shall not vote on his case.
That's not a strong finish, Gaius. He probably had a servant behind him going, ding! At that point.
So he does finish with,
okay.
So careful and guarded were the men of old in capital cases. Always refer to the past and precedent in Roman speeches. You still think it's a weak speech?
Just that, you know, that sentence there. You...
I think the translation might not help.
Yeah. Well, look, he finished well, but I do think he had a servant there with the tuning fork.
Yeah. You think that maybe that sentence was a bit rambly and they wanted him to end on something more pithy?
Exactly, yes. The Senate must clearly be concerned. They've got another Gracchus as the tribune of the plebs. That is not a situation that they wanted at all. What does Gaius Gracchus do?
So basically, he does exactly what they don't want him to do. He reintroduces those reforms and adds to them.
Mm.
Plutarch puts it directly after he stirred up the people by his speech. All right. He keeps reminding us he was most vigorous in his speaking. And he introduced two laws, says Plutarch. One of them is that he will prohibit a magistrate who has been deposed by the people from holding office a second time. Which seems fair enough, doesn't it? If the people have actually voted to get rid of a magistrate, there's going to be a reason for it. That's quite hard to do because while they're in office, technically they can't be put on trial, certainly.
Mm.
And he also establishes the right of the people to prosecute any magistrate who had exiled citizens without a trial.
Okay.
So that's kind of aimed at the kind of decision-making that had led to the death of his brother, for example. If you take action against a Roman citizen without a trial, then you are going to be held to account for that.
So it's giving the people a bit more power over the magistrates at that point.
It is. These laws are basically trying to clean up politics. Plutarch tells us, this is in chapter 4 of Gaius's life, these laws are clearly going to be directed at particular people.
Mm.
One at Marcus Octavius, who had been deposed from the tribunate by Tiberius himself. The other, Popilius, for as praetor, he had banished the friends of Tiberius.
Yeah.
So it's directly related to Tiberius.
Yeah, so he's got a revenge list, pretty much.
Yeah, so the second one takes effect, or at least it has the effect of Popilius fleeing from Italy. The other law, says Plutarch, was withdrawn by Gaius, who said that he spared Octavius at the request of his mother Cornelia. I think we might have referred to
in
our Cornelia.
That's right.
Yeah. So there's, at the same time as he's supposedly putting himself forward as a defender of the people, there are personal allegiances and considerations to be taken into account because he is an elite Roman. So he's part of this network. So those laws, they seem very personal, don't they? But they aren't both brought into effect.
Mm.
But there is more, of course. Another reform is to do with enrolling the people of Italy into Roman citizenship. So he tries to bring in a Roman citizenship for all Latin citizens. So not the whole of Italy, but the area around Rome, Latium. And Latin citizenship to the Italian allies, as they're called at the time.
Yeah.
This will be dealt with properly after Gaius's death. The social war down in the first century BCE.
Yes.
Isn't going to be settled now, but he's trying to do something that is being demanded by the Latin and the Italian allies to extend citizenship so that they get the benefits of that. A really big change is that he changes the way that the law courts function, and basically the Senate is the ultimate judge and jury in Rome. And what he does is to change the composition of this by adding 300 men from the equestrian order to the Senate to be part of this body of judges.
Now, this is something that Tiberius tried to do.
He tried to make the courts more equestrian-based, and this is going to be important. This is a conflict which will go on again into the first century with Sulla trying to change that back. And this is really about the fact that when, in particular, a magistrate has committed a crime or extorted a province or whatever it is and put on trial, they just get tried by their peers. They get tried by the senators. So if you bring the equestrians in, the idea is that it will be fairer, that you'll get a more balanced view, people who aren't biased, who aren't just part of the same team, as it were. The Senate really resists this. They really do not want this to happen. They want to be safe if they're ever brought to trial.
Yes.
Or relatively safe. And he personally selects these equestrian jurists. So he has in mind the kind of people that he wants making these decisions. So there is this idea that he himself is trying to stack the courts.
And also these people that he puts in those positions, I suppose, would owe a sense of loyalty to him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, the phrase that's coming up a lot at the moment, the quid pro quo for the Romans.
So all of these laws, the Senate hates them because it doesn't benefit them at all, but the people of Rome must have loved it.
Yeah, and partly because it's packaged together with laws that are directly aimed at benefiting them, like providing grain for the ordinary people of Rome, so a grain supply once a month, providing land for them. Land is always a big issue in this period.
Yeah.
Making sure that the military, largely the ordinary soldiers, are properly supplied and they don't have to buy their equipment out themselves. These ideas about giving them what they need for every day is, well, the Senate will see it as a popularis move. Oh, you're just trying to buy the ordinary people over. But this is to do with their daily needs.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that Gaius is aiming at the ordinary people of Rome. And he makes that symbolically clear by not facing the Senate when he's talking, by turning the other way to face the ordinary people.
Oh, so he's on the rostra outside the curia.
Mm-hmm.
And you give your speech towards the curia and speak to the Senate, but he turns the other way.
Plutarch says even popular orators before him had turned their faces towards the Senate and that part of the forum called the Comitium. You can still see broadly a Senate house in the Roman Forum. He set a new example by turning towards the other part of the forum as he harangued the people.
Mm.
So he's outdoors, but he's not facing the Senate anymore. He's making it as clear as he can in a very physical, material way, that he's for the people, not the Senate.
Yeah. So all very successful as far as the people are concerned, and he's elected tribune again for a second term?
Yes, he is. And we're told that he didn't even campaign to be tribune. It's almost just popular acclaim.
Yes.
That they love him so much. There's actually a confusing account of that in Appian, that the senatorial faction can't find more than 9 tribunes, so he gets shoved in as the 10th, which can't be true.
They'd find a 10th.
yeah, they absolutely find a 10th. And the theory on that is that Appian's slightly mangling it, that what the people could do is vote in such a way that at least one of the candidates put forward couldn't get enough votes to be viable. So the 10th one had to be Gaius. It's a bit complicated and not clear from our sources what went on, but they're all driving at he was so incredibly popular that the people would have him again. They wouldn't let him go as a tribune. They really see him as their hero.
Mm.
Plutarch actually says, chapter 6, that he found himself invested with something like monarchical power, which of course is very, very dangerous. And again, it's probably hindsight, because what happens to people who really stand out, who have this overwhelming power in Rome, they usually get torn down.
Yes.
So it's enough for the Senate that he's so popular with the people.
Yes. And they've got to put up with him for a second term. And he seems to have been, I'm not sure if he was more effective or just as effective as Tiberius. But anyway, he's definitely not somebody that they want around. So what do the Senate do? They find somebody to outdo Gaius Gracchus.
Yeah, because he is being really effective. You're right. He's getting roads built. There's no weariness. We've mentioned before he's not lazy, but he's really ticking off things on his list with astonishing speed, says Plutarch. The way that Plutarch talks about him sort of reminds me about the way people talk about Caesar.
Mm.
Right? He'll just cut through. But of course, they both annoy people by doing this.
Yes.
They probably weren't going through due process, and that's why he's getting it done so quickly. The Senate, in a way, they're quite clever at this point, because rather than just saying, no, 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 he's a bad man, let's try and distract him, get rid of him, get him somewhere else, they decide to sort of put their own candidate up.
Yeah.
Somebody who will act for the people, somebody who will win them over and maybe can be better at it than even Gaius.
So somebody who is officially sanctioned by them to be much better at the job than Gaius Gracchus is with their backing. It almost makes Gaius Gracchus look redundant.
Yeah, that's what they're aiming at. And the man that they get is Livius Drusus. He's kind of the Senate man that they put up.
The sock puppet.
Surpass Gaius in pleasing and gratifying the people, says Plutarch.
Yeah.
And he's also playing the populist game, as it were, which is interesting because the big discussion in late Republican history is whether populist players really do have the ordinary people in mind, or are they just playing for power? And were there really these two factions that only the ones called popularis were the ones playing to the people, and the Senate just kind of carried on talking about the elites? But it's very clear that those that you might put in the senatorial faction played to the people at times and were called popularis at times. So it's not as easy to divide them into these sort of quasi-political parties. And Livius Drusus is definitely playing that populist game.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's pretty much got, you know, everything that Gaius does at this point. Livius will show up and outdo him.
Yeah.
So when Gaius proposed to found two colonies, and these composed of the most respectable citizens, they accused him of trucking to the people. But when Livius proposed to found 12 colonies and to send out to each of them 3,000 of the needy citizens, they supported him.
Yeah, so they're just going to support what their man says, even if it's a more extreme version, especially because it's a more extreme version of what Gaius was going to do anyway. It is extreme hypocrisy. I have written in the margin of Plutarch here, two-faced Senate.
Yeah, essentially.
So I feel about that. And again, similarly, Plutarch's really wanting to hammer this home. With Gaius, because he distributed public land among the poor, for which every man of them was required to pay a rental into the public treasury, they were angry, alleging that he was seeking popularity. But Livius met with their approval when he proposed to relieve the tenants even from the rental. So basically just giving them the land for no rent. That's fine. So you can see the game that they're playing here, and it probably had met with a certain amount of success. Livius seems to have managed this also by saying, look, it's not me doing this. The Senate is giving you this.
Yes.
So he's trying to win the people back to the Senate to make them well disposed towards the Senate, rather than being, as the Senate would see it, in hock to one person.
Mm.
And it's exactly how politicians react, isn't it? When they see that a certain line is winning over the people who vote, they'll sort of try and move into that territory.
Yes. Yeah.
Which can be a dangerous game in modern politics.
At this point, Gaius Gracchus goes overseas to found the new Roman colony, Colonia Junonia, which is on the ruins of Carthage and is short-lived. But the Senate go, yes, off you go, get out of Rome, and pretty much use the opportunity to just slander his reputation.
They're always happy to see him go somewhere, aren't they?
Gaius picks the wrong time to go, I think.
Yeah, it may not be a great strategic move. Who knows? After all, because he has family connections to the Scipios, this may be something he feels that he can build on. This is not suggested in our sources, but you can see how it might work for him. Oh, look, I'm creating a new colony in a place that was conquered by my
brother-in-law.
Members. Yeah. But as you say, it's not the right time to be away, because Livius starts to build up attacks on him and his allies, and particularly a friend called Fulvius, who had been one of the allies of Tiberius himself. The claim from Livius Drusus is that Fulvius has been basically agitating, has been causing trouble amongst the Italian allies and urging them to revolt.
So this is coming back to that citizenship attempt.
Yeah, so this idea that, of course, the reformers have been trying to bring the Italians into the fold, as it were, but this gets turned against them.
Yeah.
They're basically being traitors if they're trying to get the allies to revolt. That's what's being alleged.
They're trying to start a social war.
Yes.
Which is less fun than it sounds. Another thing that happens at this time is we've got Scipio Aemilianus dying suddenly, and the Senate implicates Gaius Gracchus and others in his death.
Yeah, because there's this big division in that family, isn't there? That the Scipios largely are on the more conservative side, and the Gracchi are the more extremist, the more reformers, the more progressive. So you can see how an unexpected death. So Appian tells us at this point, this is in book one of the Civil Wars, chapter 20, whether this was done by Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi, aided by her daughter Sempronia, who, though married to Scipio, was both unloved and unloving because she was deformed and childless. Oh, that's a horrible
brutal
phrase. Lest the law of Gracchus should be abolished, or whether, as some think, he committed suicide because he saw plainly that he could not accomplish what he had promised, is not known. At the end of that long sentence, we don't know why this happened.
Yeah, yeah, but he implies that it might be because Scipio was trying to get rid of some of Gaius's laws.
Mm-hmm. Although these laws are important, to kill oneself over it seems like an extreme act,
yes,
even for a Roman. Also, while Gaius is away, his enemies in the Senate, including Livius Drusus and also Opimius, who's going to be important in this story, and Marcus Minucius Rufus, are allied together. They're plotting to repeal any of the laws that have been passed by Gaius Gracchus. So let's get rid of that stuff that we don't want.
Mm.
The stuff we've been pretending to the people that we want to take even further, because the Senate loves you. No, let's get rid of it all now while Gaius is out of the way.
So Gaius has to do some damage control. So he comes back to Rome and makes what is probably some unpopular decisions. Well, unpopular with the Senate, I suppose.
Yeah, he straight away continues this kind of symbolic act of being closer to the people. He's trying to win them back if he's lost them by physically moving his house close to the Forum. He'd been living on the Palatine, which is very much the posh bit of Rome, but he moves into a poorer part of Rome to be closer to, as you've written here, his core base. I like it.
His core base. Yeah, well, you need to live within your electorate.
Mm-hmm. Pretty important these days, but very, you know, senators didn't.
Yes.
They didn't live close to the people. So the consul, who's called Fannius, decides to drive non-Romans out of Rome. This is a really weird and rare example of ethnic cleansing almost that doesn't happen in Rome very much. It's normally a very multicultural place, but there's a lot of tension around the extension of citizenship, which is being, you know, they keep bringing back and failing to sort out. Gaius does not intervene even when one of his friends is driven away.
Right in front of him.
Yeah, exactly. So this isn't perhaps not a good look for Gaius.
Mm.
Maybe he's trying to be more moderate or to play more to the Senate. It doesn't work out very well for him if he is trying that.
I'd say he's just more scared of what might happen to him if he does interfere.
Well, yeah, that too.
This one I like. He removes all the seating at the gladiatorial show to allow the poor people to watch.
Yeah.
By stealth of night.
It's very odd, isn't it? Because it is like he's creeping around in camouflage gear at night or something, taking seating away. I'm sure he's got other people to do a lot of the legwork for him. Plutarch says, for this proceeding, the populace thought him a man, but his colleagues were annoyed and thought him reckless and violent. Why is he doing this weird stuff? It was believed also that this conduct cost him his election at the tribunate for the third time, so he doesn't win the third time he stands.
Mm.
Since although he got a majority of the votes, his colleagues were unjust and fraudulent in their proclamation and returns. So Plutarch says that he had the election stolen from him.
Yeah, they miscounted the votes.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't that happen to his brother as well? They ran away with the voting urns?
Yeah. I mean, we sort of think of the first century as the time when the procedures of the Republic go wrong, but we've seen a lot of them undermined here.
Mm.
Now we're coming to the really thrilling and terrifying episode, which will lead to the end of Gaius's life. But it starts not with him, but with one of his associates who is caught up in some kind of confusion. And it's different in Appian and Plutarch what happens. So I'm just going to read to you from Appian what happens to this man called Antyllus. And Appian describes him at 125 as one of the ordinary citizens who happened to be making a sacrifice in the portico. And this is on a day when Gaius is arriving on the capital, attended by bodyguards. So clearly he's in fear of his life at this point.
Mm.
And what happens to Antyllus is that he's just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Plutarch says that he is an attendant of Lucius Opimius, the consul.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives him a direct relationship to the consul, which could make him a target.
Yeah, so it's not clear. Mm. It's not even clear of the spelling of his name. It's Antyllus or Antyllius in the different accounts.
Yes.
Which is not an uncommon difference to see. Antyllus in Appian saw Gaius in a disturbed state. He put his hand on him, whether because he had heard or suspected something, or was impelled for some other reason to speak to him, and implored him to spare his country.
Mm.
Gracchus became still more agitated and fearful, like a criminal caught in the act. Appian is not very sympathetic, it has to be said, and gave him a sharp look. And one of the party, without any signal having been made or any command given, but judging simply from the sharpness of Gracchus' look at Antyllus that the vital moment had already arrived, and thinking to gratify Gracchus by being the first to strike a blow, drew his dagger and killed Antyllus.
This doesn't come across well on the podcast, but I'm trying to convey a sharp look that might condemn someone to death. I don't want anyone to kill you, Rhiannon, but, you know, is it a bit like this? Is it a bit...
I think it's
this
a bit,
is great podcasting.
I think it's a bit of a sideways look.
Okay.
Sort of suspicious, maybe.
All right. So
you can see that tensions are high, and I think that comes over in both Plutarch and Appian, even though the accounts are slightly different.
Is that why they call it a death stare? Regardless, this man is killed.
Yes.
And the consul, Lucius Opimius, can go, all right, look, they've taken it this far.
Yeah. He can now be a victim. And his body is literally used as a, look, this is proof of what these people will do.
Yes.
This Roman citizen has been killed. They can use that as a launch pad against Gaius, of course. In 14, Plutarch says that the body of Antilius was placed upon a bier without a covering and carried through the forum past the Senate House. They really make use of that body.
Mm.
Without a covering is what he stresses, with wailing and lamentations. So they're getting the people riled up.
Yeah, it's very different in Plutarch, because we've got, at any rate, he was killed at once on the spot, stabbed with a large writing stylus, said to have been made for such a purpose. Mm. This is my person stabbing stylus. It will later belong to Julius Caesar. Ah, see what he did there?
Yeah,
he remembered something.
Yes, well done.
So Gaius Gracchus goes home. The next morning, Opimius uses his death as a pretext to move against Gaius Gracchus and his allies, and the Senate votes and says that a mob can be raised.
Basically, yes.
So now we get the accounts of what happens to two different men, because the main targets of this mob, I suppose, and of the Senate's ire are Fulvius Flaccus and Gaius Gracchus. And Plutarch kind of spins it as Fulvius being very impulsive and reactionary and defensive, and Gaius Gracchus being almost a bit resigned to the fact that he's got to go along with this, maybe even believing the ghost of Tiberius's past, who came to him in a dream.
Yeah, it is certainly narrated like that by Plutarch. So this idea that he knows at this point that he's fated to die.
Mm.
So you're quite right that he just seems to accept it. From the very beginning, you know, Fulvius, he's drunk. He's roused from a drunken sleep and his men arm themselves. So he seems kind of chaotic.
Yeah.
Whereas Gaius, this is a direct quote, on the other hand, was unwilling to arm himself, but went forth in his toga, which is civic dress.
Right? Yes.
So he's emphasizing that he's an ordinary citizen, as though on his way to the forum. So as though it's an ordinary day, with only a short dagger on his person. So he did have something. And we get this scene, which I think is very literary in its inspiration. And it's something that, you know, you might recognize from films and dramas, and Shakespeare makes use of it in Julius Caesar, where Gaius's wife begs him not to go. You know it's all going to end badly when the wife begs you not to go before you go out. That's the way that those narratives work.
His young son is also clutching at his toga skirt. Is that a thing?
Yeah, it's really sad.
Mm.
But it goes back to the earliest literature we have. There's a scene in Homer's Iliad where Hector's wife and his son kind of say goodbye to him before he goes off, and his son's scared of his armor and he takes his helmet off and he hugs them and he's not going to see him again.
Yeah, but Gaius doesn't hug them. He leaves wordlessly.
This is the Roman version. You do it stoically.
Yeah,
right?
Wow.
You just go. You're resigned to your fate.
Okay. Meanwhile, Fulvius, he sends his son to the Senate, his youngest son, as a herald to negotiate. This is just a kid, I get.
It is, yeah. And I think that the reason he sends him is because he thinks that a child will be sacrosanct and safe. But
so
he's wrong.
So he sends him with a war staff. But Opimius insists on speaking directly to Fulvius and Gaius, you know, so don't hide behind this kid.
Mm, fair enough, really.
Yeah.
And demands their surrender for trial. So they are, at least on the face of it, dealing with procedure here. There will, at least according to him at this point, be a trial if they surrender themselves. Now, according to Plutarch, Gaius agrees, but Fulvius doesn't. All the way through, we're told that Gaius wants to keep it peaceful. But as you say, Fulvius is the hothead.
Mm.
The Senate, therefore, this is a pretty extreme move, sends in Cretan archers who fire on Fulvius's men. They kill some of them and they execute Fulvius on the spot, which he shouldn't do, of course. But I suppose they see this as an extreme situation.
I remember with the death of Tiberius Gracchus that they were very careful to emphasize that these weren't soldiers involved, that it was, you know, no swords were drawn in the killing of these 300 people.
Mm.
But this time it's send in the military.
Yeah, basically.
Cretan archers, off you go.
Yeah, and so Gaius very much, as you say, is accepting the situation now. He's in the Temple of Diana, and he's intending to kill himself. Plutarch chapter 16 says he sank upon his knees and with hands outstretched towards the goddess, he prayed that the Roman people, in requital for their great ingratitude and treachery, might never cease to be in servitude. So he's bitter at the end.
Mm.
For most of them were manifestly changing sides now that the proclamation of immunity had been made.
So he feels betrayed. But he is talked out of committing suicide by a couple of his friends.
Yeah, and they try to protect him. This is quite sad. They're trying to get him across the Tiber and they're going to fight until he can get past, but they're killed. Gaius has with him a single servant, says Plutarch, by name Philocrates. And though all the spectators, as at a race, seems quite an inappropriate comparison, urged Gaius on to greater speed, not a man came to his aid. So they're quite happy to say, go on, Gaius, but they're not going to help him out. Or even consented to furnish him with a horse when he asked for one. So he's kind of left on his own. It's really sad, this ending, for his pursuers were pressing close by him. He barely succeeded in escaping into a sacred grove of the Furies, which is quite appropriate because the Furies bring on vengeance, and there fell by the hand of Philocrates, who slew himself upon his master.
That's essentially assisted suicide.
Yeah, it's quite a quiet and sad end for Gaius, but he's got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
The people who were willing to help him have gone, and he's kind of left. And I feel like Plutarch might be with Gaius in spirit there, that the people have betrayed him after he had tried to work on their behalf. It's the feeling I get from reading that biography anyway. The aftermath is awful. I mean, it's really hideous that they cut his head off.
So the Senate offer a bounty for his head,
and
an individual named Septimullius cuts off his head, takes it to the consul Opimius to be paid the weight in gold, but he tries to pull a sneaky, removes the brain, replaces it with molten lead to make it heavier.
How long would that take?
You got to let it cool down.
Yeah. I mean, it may not be Plutarch making it up, but it seems like an urban legend.
Possibly. I hope so. We've also got the nice little fact of 3,000 dead in total.
Yeah, which is ramping it up from 300, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they're all thrown into the Tiber. So I don't know what state the river was in at that point. This is a punishment that you give to criminals. And their properties are confiscated. So they're looted and then confiscated, which is the beginning of this idea that this is what you do to your enemies. That your enemies can be Roman. I mean, it's not like there haven't been conflicts in the Roman Republic. Every magistracy is heavily contested. But the fact that the enemy can be an internal Roman citizen, an elite Roman citizen at that, I think this is the beginning of a change that lasts another 100 years or so. And their wives are forbidden to mourn. This is the duty of women in the household of a dead person. So that's awful. Gaius's wife, we didn't even mention her name before, Licinia, is also stripped of her dowry. So again, this is about property. The Romans are obsessed with property and the dowry belongs to the woman and her family.
Yeah.
It doesn't even belong to the husband. She does not get to keep it even though her husband's dead. Fulvius's younger son, the one who'd been sent in to negotiate but had been rejected, is executed. Although Appian says that Opimius allowed him to choose the manner of his own death, but still, he's just a kid. That's awful.
Yeah. Well, his other son, we didn't say this before, had died at his side when Fulvius had been executed. Yeah. So it's both the sons.
So they're really trying to finish these families off.
Yes.
And to dispossess them and their followers. Of course, it's meant to be a sign. People who try and do this kind of stuff or defend this kind of politician, they're going to go the same way.
This seemed pretty on the nose. Opimius celebrated with Senate approval by building a Temple of Concord in the Forum.
Yeah, this is probably a rebuilding of a temple that already exists.
Yeah, but celebrated.
Yep.
By doing that. Yeah.
And you could read it as, and I think some have read it as, he's told to do it because this is obviously now a divided society, so then you need to give us some kind of symbolic act that brings everyone together. Now, whether this would actually do it, but I think that's what it's an attempt to do, to say, we're all one nation again. We're all one state again. It's all fine. We've got rid of the problem. And I think this comes from Plutarch, does it?
Yeah.
It's regarded as an entirely insincere attempt to clothe its actions in a symbolic act of reconciliation. That's so Plutarch doesn't buy it.
That's essentially what you said. So Plutarch's agreeing with you.
Good old Plutarch. I love this bit of Plutarch because he sort of finishes off Opimius as a thoroughly bad lot. He could not keep his hands from fraud, but when he was sent as an ambassador to Jugurtha, the Numidian, he was bribed by him, and after being convicted most shamefully of corruption, he spent his old age in infamy, hated and abused by the people.
There you go.
So he does get to old age, which I'm not sure he deserves if we're moralistic about this story. But, you know, he's not popular in old age and he has been prosecuted for a really bad crime.
Mm.
And I think Plutarch is also being quite moralistic about the Roman people's actions because, you know, he's given us that very sad end of Gaius where no one will help him even though they sympathize. And then he tells us that after they're dead, the people miss the Gracchus brothers. We're like, well, a little bit late. Put up statues to them. The end of the life of Gaius, which is kind of the end of the life of both of the brothers because they are paired in Plutarch, ends entirely on Cornelia and her grief.
Yes. So now that we're on the other end of this discussion on Gaius Gracchus, do you think that he was somebody who believed in the cause, so to speak, or somebody who was out for revenge for what happened to his brother? I know you can have both, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that you're going to say, well, he's a bit of both.
Yeah,
and
I
off
am
you
a fence
go.
Sitter.
Well, here is your fence.
I don't think you can disentangle the two because I think he did believe in the cause because this is a dangerous road to go along. And if he didn't want these changes to happen, and he was very effective with some of them, at least for a short amount of time, then you wouldn't have started on that. I mean, he could have had a perfectly respectable senatorial career by just towing the line.
He could have raised an army in Sardinia and charged into Rome.
I guess so. I think that he did believe in the cause. I'm going to put myself out there. But if he believed in the cause, in a way, he has to be somebody who cares about what happened to Tiberius. Mm. And he's also his brother. So they're all wrapped up together. You can't really disentangle them. But our sources, and Appian in particular, strongly imply that Gaius was also out for himself. We also can't disentangle this from what happens in the first century BCE, which, of course, Plutarch and Appian are quite well aware of what's going to come of this conflict between the more conservative senatorial faction and those who strive to get their popularity from and to work for the people. So they will become huge names and celebrities. And I think they see not really Tiberius, but Gaius as the first of these, who is working to be really famous with the people.
Mm.
In a way, part of his comeuppance is that in the end, the people won't even help him.
And the other aspect of this is that these ideas don't go away. We've got the social wars coming up.
The rights of the Latins and
That's
Italians
right, yeah.
will still be disputed.
And then you've got people like Julius Caesar and Clodius capitalizing on these ideas in their own
yeah.
ways.
So the question of land doesn't go away. And the question of land gets even more crucial because when these individuals, these celebrities, as it were, Julius Caesar, Pompey, and others become very successful in warfare and building empire, they have armies to settle. So it's not only the land that the poor and increasingly the urban poor need, but also the land that you want to settle your veterans on. In a way, the question of land becomes even more vital in the first century BC. So that's not going away. They need the land reform. They need the Senate to start giving up some of this land that they've amassed. And the idea of who judges the senatorial class and the magistrates is going to go back and forth.
Mm.
So Sulla is going to reload that with people from senatorial backgrounds. And so it'll go between Sulla and then Caesar. It'll swing back and forth. We will sort out what happens to the Italian allies. That at least gets sorted, but not before we have a war. So yeah, the Senate think that they've won at this point, but they really haven't. They've just buried the problems for a while.
So ultimately, to these causes, the Gracchi, they're both martyrs. They're both poster childs. They're ultimately held up as people who died for these causes.
Yeah, and you can see the sign of that in the fact that statues are put up of them afterwards. They continue to be heroes. So poster boys is exactly the right phrase. And Gaius shows us that Tiberius wasn't a one-off. So really, the Senate should have learned the lesson that if we have first Tiberius, then Gaius, it's not going away. There may be no more Gracchus brothers to take on that cause, so maybe it goes away a bit longer, but others are going to come along and work for the people.
That's Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are, as always, very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.